Hey, this is Wes Allwyn. You may or may not know that The Partially Examined Life is not just a philosophy podcast, it's also a blog. If you're a writer and you'd like to blog for us or submit essays related to philosophy, culture, and ideas, please go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/write.
We are reviving the Introductory Readings in Philosophy Not School Group. In March, this Not School Group will focus on the Crito by Plato. For more information about Not School and the Introductory Readings in Philosophy group, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com. You're listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who were at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 134 is, how does thought relate to reality? Or maybe just, what is philosophy? And we read the introductory sections to G.F.W. Hegel's Science of Logic from 1812 and his Encyclopedia Logic from 1817. You can join the discussion, get the texts, and lots more information at partiallyexaminedlife.com. This is Mark Linsenmeyer with Absolute Knowing from Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Wes Allwyn negating himself in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Dylan Casey dialectically in Middleton, Wisconsin.
This is Amogue Sahu with the identity of thought and being in Toronto, Canada.
Welcome, Amogue. You're our resident, well, I won't say expert, but...
you're not our resident, you're our alien expert.
Yeah, I mean, I'm into Hegel. I'm somewhat... I wouldn't call myself a Hegelian because there's some seriously weird stuff in there. But I'm definitely psyched about reading the Logic.
Folks might remember Amogue from some of our after shows that you appeared on, and you run your own podcast on now, Symptomatic Redness, with one of our former guests, C. Derek Varn. And what else do we need to know about you?
I'm an undergrad at the University of Toronto.
Undergrads that are way into Hegel. That's a... You know, I like, the phenomenology fascinated me at the time, but this book I never touched. So we should explain, the Science of Logic is the so-called Greater Logic. And it's the hard book. It's the thick book.
800 pages, approximately.
Yes. And we just read the parts really just explaining what logic is, according to him. It was released in three volumes. The part we read was released in 1812. Also, part of what we read was a second preface, which was actually from 1830. It's one of the very last things he wrote. And then the encyclopedic logic, the so-called lesser logic, was released afterward when Hegel figured out that his undergraduates could not understand his Science of Logic at all. So he wrote this shorter thing and then also through a couple of additions added to it. So I believe, again, the last version, the one that we're actually looking at, is the 1831.
Right. What's interesting is that the Logic is actually published before the sort of three-part Encyclopedia of Philosophical Sciences, which is like the completed system, the completed Hegelian system. So if you want to work through the Encyclopedia Logic and the two other books, that's when you get the whole thing.
So this is a guy who's ballsy enough to write a set of volumes and call it The Encyclopedia.
The Encyclopedia, yeah, the definite article.
It's not that he contributed articles to, you know, that he was a specialist about sea snakes and he wrote the sea snake article in the Encyclopedia Britannica. It's Hegel's Encyclopedia.
Hegelpedia.
Well, he did have some modesty.
Welcome to my encyclopedic knowledge, which he did have, actually. So from looking at those lecture notes, it's like, wow.
Yeah.
This guy is...
I mean, I don't have any kind of science background, so I didn't have the cringes at the 19th century science that's in here. Perhaps to a different reader, some of the encyclopedic knowledge might appear. It's been outdated, right, for 2016 readers.
Yeah, but there's a lot of good stuff going on in the 19th century.
Totally.
One of my colleagues who's a Hegel scholar, her comment about him was that he lived at a time when it was probably still possible to basically read anything worth reading and have read it all.
Right.
And he was the person who did it.
Huh.
That is just functionally impossible now.
Yeah.
Nowadays, yeah.
You know, late 1700s, that was still possible.
The world spirit has too many little articulations and eddies now.
And right.
We are caught in...
It's no longer a unity of universals with particulars swimming about in them.
Right.
he would not be happy with the Hegel literature. It'd be too dispersed for him. Which is actually not too vast. Nowadays, there's been a bit of a resurgence in commentary about this book on the logic, but generally, this is the book which you run away from if you've been educated in the US or in England.
So we have two episodes, really a two-episode string on a good chunk of Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit, which was his first book. And I guess he started this book, the early part of it, right after that. And it was supposed to be the sequel. Folks might know from other episodes that we've done that phenomenology usually is about describing experience. Can we give sort of an objective take on this is what I'm experiencing? And so then you could look at the same phenomenon and report the same thing. We're not just reporting about the stray thoughts that go through your mind as you look at something. It's not an artistic exercise. It's supposed to somehow get at the essences of things. It's supposed to somehow be objective and scientific, even though you're just examining your own experience. Now, Hegel's writing 100 years before that idea of phenomenology came up with guys like Edmund Husserl, but this is what influenced that. Folks will have to go back and listen to our Phenomenology of Spirit episode for, I think, an accurate description of that. But he goes through the different ways that you could describe experience from the simplest. So it's not examining your experience, but it's sort of imagining like what the simplest kind of animal would experience. So it starts with sense certainty, and then it gets more and more complex in how we might then attribute, say, forces within things. That's supposed to get, at the end of the story, to absolute knowing, that he's established somehow this method by which what he thinks of as true science is possible, and how this arises out of the interaction, the natural growth of spirit. And spirit is just kind of like mind, but generalized. It's not my mind. It's not your mind. In fact, it's great that we just did Aristotle's De Anima, because the way he talked about nous is reflected throughout here.
Nous poetica. It's one interpretation of the...
Yes. Hegel talks explicitly about the world spirit. We also had a past episode on Hegel's philosophy of history being the action of the world spirit, sort of realizing itself, and has a very mechanical view of how things progress.
In the things we read, he's going to talk about it as an infinite being or as God.
It's important that you define spirit in that way, because he often talks about spirituality or the spiritual, which tends to have certain connotations to modern readers. Obviously of being a certain kind of like theological substance. And that's not quite what he means, as your definition of spirit suggests. It's bound up with theology in some way, right? So he keeps talking about how God will be actualized by the idea and so on. But the spiritual idea is more connected with the notion of mind and thinking about the world.
Yes. And the fact that when it's not a matter of just your mind thinking about the particulars of your life, when it reflects on the deep structures of things, when it reflects on universals, then it is engaging in objective thought. Anybody who is thinking clearly, who is contemplating the same thing, is going to be able to get in touch with these objective thoughts. And again, think of that like mathematics. In a way that you could say mathematics is given an experience in that, well, okay, I see two books, I see two whatever. You can kind of come up with counting. But once you get rid of the particulars of your experience and not books, then you're contemplating universals. You're contemplating these numbers, you're contemplating laws. And this is how he thinks that this science is supposed to work. I just brought up the phenomenology to establish the background that somehow, and he explicitly says, look, I already proved that this is possible. This kind of knowledge is possible in the previous book. This book is all about explaining what this kind of knowledge is. And then after the part that we read, then apparently giving a lot more details on zoology and I don't know, a lot of stuff that I didn't look at.
Yeah, the rest of the logic goes into detail about pretty much everything. Ethical life, art, chemistry, biology, and it's all supposed to connect together in this big, broad system.
And it's funny that you're going to talk about Wes. Why does he call this the logic?
Right.
Yeah, so I think most of us are used to thinking of logic. The kind of logic you're going to be taught in a logic class has to do with the forms of valid arguments. For instance, modus ponens is a logical form. So if it rains, it pours. It rains, therefore it pours. That form tells you whether an argument is going to be valid, which is not to say true, because you could have erroneous premises. And I think I just gave an example of an argument like that. So the conclusion could be valid without being true. The kind of logic Hegel is talking about comes from the philosophical tradition via Kant and Aristotle, where you're thinking about the fundamental structure of the world. So you're thinking probably we would call it something more akin to ontology or even in some forms, metaphysics. So for instance, you're going to hear a lot about categories or allusions to categories by Hegel in the text we read.
Categories are something Kant focused on, but he sort of inherited them from Aristotle. For Aristotle, they were all the different ways we could say that something exists or is. They're very general categories of being. So you might have substance or quantity or quality or relation or where or when. So we can say, hey, look at that thing out there. Look at that human being. And that's a substance. It's something as primary substance that you can predicate things of, but that's not predicated of anything. But you might say there are two human beings. That's another category of predication, so on. Kant inherits these, and he's thinking about them not in terms of the structure of things exactly, but in terms of what it is that's required for experience. Suddenly we've gone from being to experience. Kant is thinking about the grounds for the possibility of experience, and for him, he's going to think he deduces these logical categories just because they are what's necessary for us to have an experience. So we have to have substances, experience has to be causal, and it has to be quantitative, and a long list of other things in order to count as experience. That's the most immediate, along with some other idealists, neo-Kantian idealists. That conception of logic is what Hegel is responding to here and critiquing and amending.
Right. What's interesting about our modern conception of logic, right, is it's very symbolic and talks about various sort of devices like quantifiers and so on and so forth. It's obviously in the 18th century, they didn't have a lot of that apparatus, which came in with people like Frege. What they do talk about, as you mentioned, as Aristotle and Marx were talking about the syllogism, is the kind of subject-predicate structure of a sentence and stuff like conceptual containment, i.e., you know, you got a sentence like, all bodies are divisible. This is straight Kant, but it's very important for Hegel. You want to talk about whether the predicate divisibility is contained in the definition of the subject, body. And this is how Kant gets into stuff like analytic judgments or synthetic judgments. Judgment, which is conducted by this faculty that Kant calls the understanding, I mean, which is connected with the way we think about things. And they typically think this thought is like structured in this propositional sense, which is all bodies are divisible, is a nice example. That's more what we're working with when we're talking about logic. Wes mentioned the conditions of possibility for experience. That's what Hegel calls, and Kant calls, transcendental logic. The way our thought interacts with lays the foundation for experience. But they also have, the German idealists also have a sense of logic which is closer to our understanding, which is something like this notion of formal logic, which is just simply the rules for thought, the way concepts are defined, and so on and so forth.
The focus here for Hegel is what he calls objective logic, which is sort of the inheritor of transcendental logic.
Right. The sense in which we might think about logic today is something that, you know, is purely concerned with something like the symbolic realm, which stands apart from experience. That is a conception he's dealing with, right? When he talks about, here's this conception of logic that people talk about, but I'm going to reject that.
He's going to talk about everyday logic.
Totally, right.
Yeah. Well, he's going to reject it as not comprehensive enough, that it ends up being subsumed by this larger thing that he's dealing with, that what we might consider logic is just dealing sort of with the empty shells, purely with formal aspects.
Well, no, he's already, at that point, he's already into a critique of transcendental logic. Early on in the second preface, he's going to talk about the use of logic for our own purposes, right? Sort of the application of logic to everyday affairs, to fulfill our own desires, and just logic in a very common sense way. The logic he's going to be concerned with is going to elevate itself above that and even elevate itself above the constraints of Kantian logic.
Which has this kind of formal character. I mean, it's difficult, a sort of like sustained critique of Kant, I mean, is throughout the whole text, but you get a sense of what he's going to say across the introduction when he talks about the critical philosophy. That's generally a reference to the Critique of Pure Reason, which is obviously Kant's major work. This notion that thought should stand apart from the world is really what he's denying. This idea that there's a cleavage between the way we think about the world and the way that the world is, which can never be passed. This kind of idea of this fundamental gap between thought and reality is the proposition that the logic wants to challenge. You want to show the identity of thought and reality.
Let's say more about what that is in Kant.
What's the distinction between thinking and experience, right?
Right.
Well, it's a distinction that arises between things in themselves and appearances. So for Kant, we get divorced from the world, and we get divorced from the world by treating these logical categories of experience as if they were purely subjective. And this is the difference between absolute idealism and the subjective idealism, Kant's transcendental idealism, which, according to Hegel, is a form of subjective idealism in which what we call things, what we call objects, they're just appearances, and they depend upon the human mind. When Hegel is talking about the world as idea or mind, it is not the ideas of any particular human being. It's not even human cognitive structure, as what we're talking about in Kant. It's something that's more basic than that. It's something that ends up being structurally common to both subject and object. And subject and object will fall out of that. We could call it the objective logic of the world. Should we move through the text, maybe?
Yes.
Since it's so difficult. I think we should start with the science of logic.
Yes, let's do the science of logic. It's what we said we were going to focus on, right?
So, you know, in the preface, in the first preface, we immediately get this complaint about Kant, that the understanding wasn't allowed to soar above experience. The whole thing is sort of a lamentation of the downfall of metaphysics and the neglect of science. Kant is putting a big check on metaphysics. He's saying that these categories of experience are applicable only to empirical experience. They are sort of the handmaiden of the sciences and of everyday experience, and so that you don't get to use them for metaphysics. So, for instance, let's take the category of substance. It's important in Kant that for anything to be an experience, it has to be accompanied by the representation, I think. But what we don't get to do with Kant is to hypostatize, reify, and say that it is a substance, as philosophers did in traditional metaphysics, that it is a substance that in a way is analogous to the kind of tangible stuff of the world that we get to see and touch, and that we can rightfully call a substance. For Kant, the I think is sort of it's a condition of the possibility of experience, but it's sort of something that lies at the edge of experience. It's not within the world of experience. It's sort of a feature of the subject. And so we don't get to say that it's a metaphysical substance existing somewhere in the world. That's the whole idea of what the critique is. You know, critique just means he's going to say we can't talk about these crazy metaphysical objects that philosophers traditionally wanted to talk about. He's going to allow us actually to talk about them, but we can't say that they're objects of knowledge. We can't say that there's some science of these things.
They act as like guides to our practical action, right? Regulative ideas and so on.
Yes, exactly. For Hegel, that's the problem. So what's left there, though, is that we can't be solipsists. Even though for Kant, there are all these categories that we use to construct the world, including causality and substance and quantity and so on, there's a given, there's some sort of data that's coming in that we are shaping with our minds. And where is that data coming from? Well, we posit this thing in itself outside of us, which is itself completely unknown to us, right? Because what's known to us are our own representations that we've constructed according to these means. But we sort of need this little appendix.
We need a source. It's not an appendix. It's a source, but it's an unknowable source.
Well, Hegel's going to want to cut it out. So that's what I'm using. Even though we can't know it, we need this idea of Kant sometimes calls it object equals X, this unknown, indeterminate thing out there that isn't causing, quote unquote, our representations, because causality actually can't be a relation between us and this thing, because causality is just a category.
It just holds for objects of experience.
Right? Yeah. And there's an irony here, which is that the whole idea of substance as a logical category in our sort of naive, realistic way we approach the world is to talk about things in themselves. That's what we think we're doing, and that's what we think the concept of substance captures. It's an enormous irony in Kant that you can't use substance to talk about things in themselves. You can't use substance to talk about the very thing that in a way, substance naively is meant to capture. So Hegel wants to make metaphysics possible again by shattering this self-contradictory view that Kant has put forth.
One important criticism that Hegel has is this faculty he calls the understanding, which is, I mean, you mentioned the I think. Kant thinks the understanding makes these judgments, and I mentioned all bodies divisible. And he bases the way we cut up the world on the so-called categories, which are the kind of ancestral basic concepts. You mentioned cause and substance and so on, which structure the way we basically make the objects of experience possible. Hegel's criticism of that way of looking at things is that this faculty called the understanding kind of separates, I mean, he calls it a one-sided way of doing things. It separates things into these sort of neat conceptual categories and rigidifies the world in a certain way based on this kind of I think, this kind of formal structure which makes judgments about the world. And it's always referred back to a certain kind of notion of the I, right? It's not a single person, but it's this kind of formal structure. For Hegel, what really matters is the formality of the whole thing, the fact that these structures don't really exist in the world, but kind of exist apart from the world and structure it in some way. And the resulting structure of the thing in itself, because, you know, given that these concepts structure the world in a certain way, there has to be something that stands outside the way we look at the world. He thinks that equivocation and this whole kind of formal structure of the eye is a bad way of looking at things.
Yeah, well, ultimately, logic becomes its own content. It becomes its own thing in itself that we have access to. That's the sort of way out of the maze. I think actually maybe we should start with the introduction.
General Concept of Logic, page 23 of the Cambridge translation.
He's going to compare this project of logic to other sciences, which usually you're going to establish premises and methods, right? And he's going to say that's not what we can do here.
Well, it's what we can do, but we can't do it initially. We need to take half the book to do it. The method has to generate itself. The method ends up being a result of doing it. Somewhere in the encyclopedia, he says something to the effect of, you might think that before we try to do metaphysics, first we have to look at the mind and decide whether metaphysics is even possible. That was Kant's claim, and that just sounds so reasonable, but that's not really how it works. The only way you can test out whether the skin can do what you want it to do is just to go ahead and do it.
Right. He has this famous line about wanting to learn how to swim before one is plunged into the water.
Exactly, yeah.
Which is in the Encyclopedia Logic. Let's just go ahead and do it, and let's see if we can't get at that thing in itself that you say we can't get to, right? Or something like that.
Right.
It makes it sound just like Aristotle again, especially with the concept of something like virtue, right? You become virtuous by doing virtuous things.
So much of this is Aristotelian.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. This is a return to Aristotle in many senses, yeah.
It's saturated with that. I mean, from the fact that there's a kind of teleology to the way we think about the world and all that kind of stuff. And also the idea that we can divide up all human pursuits and kind of unite them in some way, logic, ethics, science, and so on.
Do we want to just kind of march through page by page or whatever?
Sure. 23, he's talking about the sense in which logic cannot presuppose any forms of reflection as opposed to other sciences, which you establish a method and you establish certain premises and so on. There's no starting from premises here. It should make us curious about how it's going to get started.
Right. I mean, the point is that reflection on method is part of philosophy in a way that it isn't quite in other disciplines, right? There's a self-reflexive structure which is unique to speculative science as opposed to empirical science.
In the middle paragraph, so these forms of reflection, they are part of its content, and they first have to be established within it. So instead of, for instance, starting out with the scientific method and applying that, we are establishing the method as we go. It is the content of this science, is its own method.
It's part of it, yeah. I mean, you can't. Logic, on the contrary, cannot presuppose any of these forms of reflection, these rules and laws of thinking, for they are part of its content, and they first have to be established within it. Both the formal structure of what you're doing and the content of it are combined, right? There's no, like, here's the methodological treatise, and here's me going ahead and doing it. Both of them have to be derived from, like, the same stem.
Well, let's give an example of the way in which logic normally isn't doing what he wants it to do. On page 24, he is sort of characterizing what the problem of logic is, and he gives several different steps to it. The first one is that he says that to say that logic abstracts from all content, that is, that it only teaches the rule of thinking without being able to engage in what is being thought or to take its composition into consideration, this alone is already inadequate. So right there, he's honing in on the idea that you would be talking about, well, the examples given at the beginning about syllogisms where the truth value of them didn't matter, right? It was all about just the structure of them, and that was what the logic was about. And here, right from the beginning, he's saying that's not sufficient for logic. The content is imbued in the activity of the logic itself. You see right away that the question of truth value is going to be important, and that's going to be the avenue by which you get to absolute truth, is because you don't jettison it from the beginning in your logic. You don't have, right from the outset, this dichotomy between being able to talk about truth and falsity on the one hand in terms of evaluating statements, but not being able to talk about the truth of anything because you don't know if the premises that you started with were truthful at all. You just abstract that out from the beginning, right? And then talk about that as if that were talking about the structure of thought. And Hegel's saying that is an insufficient beginning, and you have to retain the content in there.
All right, let's stop for a minute and talk about our sponsors. We're going to bring in Seth Paskin, our missing member.
Folks, we've been talking a lot about the great courses here at PEL, and we're excited about their new offering, the Great Courses Plus Video Learning Service. Now, this is unlimited access to a huge library of Great Courses lecture series in many, many fascinating subjects like science, history, philosophy, and so on. We really love the Great Courses Plus, and they're giving our listeners an incredible opportunity right now. You can watch one of their popular courses, The Fundamentals of Photography, absolutely free. Now, The Fundamentals of Photography is filmed in partnership with the National Geographic and is taught by professional photographer Joel Sartori. Now, I've been watching it, and I really enjoyed it. I think I've told you about a couple of the different lectures that we've already watched. It's a great way to learn how to take stunning photographs like a pro, helping to capture the memories of what you see and experience in your life. Now, the latest episode I was looking at was almost at the end on editing, and he walks you through how he chooses which picture to take between several photographs of crater lakes in Uganda. And it's really fascinating. Of course, the pictures are beautiful, but it's really fascinating how he just compares and contrasts the different pictures and tells you why he selected one over the other. Now, just for a limited time, the Great Courses Plus is offering you, PEL listeners, a chance to stream this course, The Fundamentals of Photography, which is a $235 value, as well as hundreds of other courses for free. You can stream from any internet-connected TV, PC, or through the Great Courses Plus apps. But this free offer is only available for a limited time, so hurry. To stream The Fundamentals of Photography from the Great Courses Plus for free, you must go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/PEL. Thanks to the Great Courses, and thanks to you. Now back to the show.
There's a kind of anti-skeptical motivation here as well. I mean, it's a common objection that skeptics have as to, hey, well, you got your fancy little system there, and you've derived it using these kind of methodological premises. But, you know, if I deny those methodological premises, I can reject your conclusions, right?
Yes.
Hegel wants to kind of demonstrate that, no, you don't have that line of escape. You have to adopt these premises because we're going to kind of derive our methodological structure within the system itself. So there's kind of, you can't point there and say, where does that come from? We're going to show you where it comes from.
The next sentence after what Dylan just read sounds like he's going to be talking about psychology. For since thinking and the rules of thinking are supposed to be its subject matter, that is the subject matter of philosophy, in these, logic already has a content specifically its own. In them, it has that second constituent of knowledge, namely a matter whose composition is its concern. So that sounds like, oh, the rules of thinking, what is that? So you might interpret that as we're not just talking about the abstract logical forms, but we're talking about individuals actually thinking of it. We need to bring in human psychology somewhere. But that is something that he is not in. And I think historically, this is where, you know, by the time we get to Frege and Russell and sort of the birth of analytic philosophy, they are reacting to British Hegelians. They are reacting to these guys who they characterize as engaging in psychologism. That the problem with these Hegelians is that they need to just go back a little more like what Aristotle was doing and just look at the forms of reasoning rather than contingent facts about how human beings actually reason. But Hegel himself is very adamant that he thinks that that psychologism stuff is a bunch of baloney too. And in fact, he thinks that in the history of logic is such that no real advances had been made since Aristotle until his time. And that for him, current logic books just took Aristotle and dressed it up with all sorts of irrelevant, contingent matters of psychology that are kind of like what we would think of as the informal fallacies. You know, this slippery slope argument that when you talk about these things, you're kind of talking about, well, these are mistakes that human beings often make, that you kind of feel like you have to understand how people reason, at least wrongly, in order to then get at good reasoning.
Right. Another point to make about Kant and his psychologism, as well as Hegel, is that you're talking about mind in a certain sense, but you're not sort of doing empirical psychology, right? This kind of investigation of the structures which underlie these contingent facts. And anyway, Hegel kind of denies the distinction we draw between necessary and contingent, right? Because he's giving this account of how if we look at things in a certain way, the contingent stuff becomes necessary in a sense.
That's not a point that's going to make sense thrown in at this point.
Yeah. I mean, you have to kind of plug through the whole structure to kind of demonstrate how.
What do you mean by the contingent becomes necessary? I have a vague idea of the facts of the world flowing from
the logos,
logical structure of the world. Yeah.
If you understand the kind of progression of the way concepts and the world link up, right, eventually you'll understand that concepts are arranged in a way that things have to be the way they are because they have to be, right? The kind of conceptual structure with which the world is thought, once it's brought to its full intelligibility, once we work through all of these different like historical conceptions, we begin to realize that thought and the world, the way we think about the world and the way the world is, and also the way the world could be, kind of collapse into this big one, which he calls the idea.
So in other words, history, it's like an organic development, say analogous to development, say from a seed into a plant, and there's a necessity to it. So contingency, you know, when we talk about contingency, right, we mean, among other things, the particular facts of history. And these things, for Hegel, are an offshoot of the necessary development of spirit, let's say. So that's the sense in which this distinction, I think, is denied.
There's also this whole stuff about possibility, right? I mean, we normally think about, hey, well, there's the actual world and there's all this sort of ways the world could be. And in Kant, there's this whole notion of conditions of possibility, which is like there's a certain logical structure of the world, like the principle of non-contradiction and so on. But there's also certain empirical physical facts, but they didn't have to be this way. They could have been another way. Hegel will kind of deny that whole logical possibility, real possibility distinction. The world is the way it could be.
There's a quote from later from the Encyclopedia, section 6, where he's actually quoting his own preface to the Philosophy of Right. This is one of the later editions, you know, his commentary. It's 29 of the Hackett version of the Encyclopedia that we have. It's section 6. So he quotes himself that he had said in the preface to the Philosophy of Right, what is rational is actual, and what is actual is rational. And he says, these simple propositions have seemed shocking to many, and they have been attacked even by those who are not ready to renounce the possession of philosophy, and certainly not that of religion. The explanation of that is that there's a logos. Like, what this science, what this absolute knowing is trying to get at is that, just as Aristotle thought, just as Heraclitus thought, that underneath the seeming contingency of everyday events is a law-like structure.
There's a one.
Yes.
Right?
There's a logos.
Well, and I guess the distinction between it being a one versus a logos would be is that the logos would allow for there being parts that were identifiable, but they were all related to one another such that they formed a one. In Heraclitus, you have the ratio or the relation that does not deny the distinction between the two parts of it, but they together themselves form a single relation.
But the oneness, and I think we got at this in Aristotle, that it's not the oneness of Brahmanism or something where all the particularities actually illusory.
No, that's what I meant, that the particulars are in fact exactly embodied, but they form a one. So you can't have the ratio without having the two things. There's no longer a ratio. It would be one thing. You have parts, but they are held together in a ratio. And the ratio is the one.
The parts are sort of display this structure, which means that they have to be understood in the sense of the whole. I mean, we can obviously have all of these people looking at a certain section of the thing, but Hegel thinks once you tie them all together, they'll display this one-like structure.
Yeah. And in that way, it also provides the means by which you can get to know one, and then you get to know the rest of it as well, because there's a logos to the whole that allows you to have access to other parts of the world, from one part of the world to other parts of the world. It's a fundamental notion of connectedness that makes the world intelligible. I mean, to me, it's like saying that it's so obvious, because without that principle, the world is simply not intelligible. And that's the strongest evidence that it's true, is that the world is intelligible.
Yeah. I mean, he talks about every philosophy being a kind of, there's a sense in which that can be taken as a platitude, right? But there's actually a lot of skeptical arguments and what he sees as bad understandings of this one, which allows him to explain why people haven't happened upon this kind of universal structure if it's there. Because there's all sorts of ways people can misapprehend the structure because it's so universal and totalizing and there's so much stuff to run together.
Well, yes, it's hard for people to focus on universals. He distinguishes throughout here between getting at a universal somehow, boring in and going toward this absolute knowledge, from merely abstracting, which is the way we normally would think as a good empiricist is the way you think you get at universals. I used mathematics as an example before. Well, according to Hegel, the way we do mathematics is just by abstracting from the individual things we see. So it actually becomes in some way paler, right? This is the thing he was objecting to at the beginning, that if you think logic is just about the content-free forms of things, well, that's just abstraction. And Hegel is adamantly against abstraction. He thinks that real thinking somehow leaps in and engages with the actual sensuous content, but is able to grasp the universal by converting these sensations, these notions into thoughts, into concepts, turning the, what he called the Vorstellungs.
The thoughts are out there in the world. There's actually a good quote on it in this introduction here.
Take us back, yes.
It's on page 25 or 26, so skipping ahead a little bit. I do want to come back to where we were, but he's praising traditional metaphysics and lamenting the departure from it.
What's the first line of the paragraph you're on?
I'm in my notes.
Is it the older metaphysics?
Yes, yes.
The older metaphysics had in this respect a higher concept of thinking. That's the one.
Yeah, so this is on page 25. For it presupposed as its principle that only what is known of things and in things by thought is really true in them. This made me think, by the way, of Danima. That is, what is known in them, not in their immediacy, but as first elevated to the form of thinking as things of thought. So in other words, I'm thinking of the way Aristotle describes the engagement of nous with the world and its potentiality and its complete openness. And we reach a point in Danima where basically, there is no distinction between the noose that's thinking and the thing that's thought. They are the same thing.
I wrote in the margin of the next sentence, this is a characterization of Aristotle.
Right.
So the rest of the paragraph is, this metaphysics thus held that thinking and the determination of thinking are not something alien to the subject matters, but are rather their essence, or that the things and the thinking of them agree in and for themselves, that thinking in its imminent determinations and the true nature of things are one and the same content.
It's ambiguous in that it sounded like you were, in the case of Aristotle, they were numerically the same. They were one and not just of the same type. In other words, they were
identical. They were the same thing, not equal things.
Exactly. And maybe that's the case here. The way that I was reading, and he kind of goes on about this at length later on in the parts of the encyclopedia that were sort of in the optional later portion, that
right.
Is that this distinction between the Vorstellung, which is the representations, which he sometimes called the notion, but it really comes down to this immediacy. So the way that we immediately encounter things, we perceive them, we imagine them, we feel them, all these things that a lot of people, you know, he really rails in the prefaces about the upshot of the Kantian cutting us off from the thing in itself is that people have just become thinking that all there is to philosophy is just what I immediately feel, what my immediate impressions are. I'm doing philosophy. Look, like, but he wants to get beyond these Vorstellung to actual thought, to Denken, which gives us, instead of the notions, to the concept, which is Begriff in German. So that's the big thing that he's going at.
And these things are, yeah, again, not subjective. They are part of the world.
This isn't supposed to depend on any particular person's mind, right?
Yes. So, yes.
I guess it is the same, thinking further, as Aristotle, that you are not just getting... So he talks about these Vorstellungs. They're actually kind of metaphors for the actual content, the truth, that only thought, doing philosophy, is converting these pre-philosophical perceptions and notions, dreams, whatever, desires, wills, all these things into thought. And thought is the only thing that's really objective, that's really getting at the matter. But it's really this one and the same matter. It's kind of disguised. It's layered in everyday experience. It's a matter of actually making this immediate. And the truth is buried in the immediate somewhere, but it's making it from immediate into mediated. It's mind looping around to know itself. That's what thought ends up being.
Right.
That's exactly right. My favorite quote, which sort of makes that point very nicely, is on 24 of The Science of Logic. Presupposed from the start is that the material of knowledge is present in and for itself as a ready-made world outside thinking. That thinking is by itself empty, that it comes to this material as a form from outside, fills itself with it, and only then gains a content, thereby becoming real knowledge, right?
I was going to read that as well. So I love that quote. Yeah.
There's a certain idea of like engaging with the actual world and thinking. I mean, he uses these metaphors of like labor and the phenomenology of spirit. There's all this stuff about violence of like thinking and rethinking to make thought conform to the world in a certain sense. It's not an easy thing. I mean, he's certainly not saying that any halfway house thought that anybody has in the world is sort of all being compressed in itself.
This is the view he's rejecting, right?
Right.
Okay, just make sure we understand that.
Right, so it's like when Mark was talking about numerical identity, right? It's thought understood in a certain way is being. It's not simply any thought, any mental act is the world. Is the idea.
What I was trying to figure out was, is it a matter of, because it sounds like if you just say the content of the truth is the same content that shows up but in disguised form in everyday experience, are you talking about numerical identity or just talking about sort of a type identity, the other side? And I think it might actually be numerical identity, just like Aristotle said, that it's not merely that you decode and you get at, oh, okay, I see actually that deep in my daydreams, it's talking about the same thing. I mean, it's definitely another instance. It's a different mental act.
Think of it this way. There's this underlying rational thing, the world. And in the moment where Mark is thinking of something or comes to understand the essence of something, let's say, that's the moment where that structure becomes available to itself. It's thinking itself through you. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it certainly is numerically identical because it just is that being. And yes, when you think it, it's just that being available to itself through you.
Yeah.
So
your thoughts themselves are a way that the world is.
Yeah.
One thing that's true both for Aristotle and then I think is double down true for Hegel is that as physical entities, as beings in the world, we are a manifestation of that world. We are part of that world and thinking is part of that. And that all of that is true. And it provides us with direct contact with the world. And it can't possibly be any other way than that because we exist as a manifestation of that.
Mm-hmm. What he's denying is that thought has this cordoned off bit of reality where it can kind of step away from the world and kind of engage in these thought experiments about possible worlds and so on and so forth, and still remain above the world without remaining in the world.
Yeah.
Is the way I like to think of it.
But let's remind ourselves the reasons why people would make that separation, right?
Right.
It has to do with being wrong.
Right.
About things. What's the mechanism for being wrong? And it also has to do with the distinctions between what we experience in a prima facie way and what we later on understand to have happened. You know, we look out in the world and we see, oh, look, the stick is being bent in the water, but oh, it's a straight stick.
Yeah. But even further, modern science, which is where we get this distinction between primary and secondary qualities, which is the beginning of the collapse into Kantianism. So for instance, we say, oh yeah, there's a red thing out there. And then doing science, we say, well, actually, it's a spatiotemporal object that sends waves of a certain frequency to another spatiotemporal object, the eye. And arising through that is this perception of a color. So it's this idea that comes about, I think, through the science of perception that the world is mediated somehow from us. And that when we scientifically investigate things and we get to the truth of things, we've gotten underneath a perceptual veil. The problem is you can treat, as Kant does, spatiotemporality as just another layer of that veil until you completely strip it away and all you're left with is the bare thing in itself, which I can't say anything about, and everything is a veil.
The one thing to emphasize is that he isn't denying that you can be wrong. I mean, firstly, he makes all kinds of statements that accusing people of being wrong, but also there's a sense in which what's really important to stress is the intelligibility of the world, the fact that it can be made right. sense of, and that our sense-making displays this kind of historical structure. It evolves over time and so on.
Legitimate philosophy can't be wrong. It could be partial. It could be not something that will be eventually overcome in a more comprehensive philosophy. There's a progression of legitimate philosophies that have come through history, just in the way that there have been progression of governments and all the other things that he thinks there have been a progression of. And plenty of philosophers then, he's going to say, are just really not doing philosophy at all. They're not on the map. They're not on the dialectical trail. Maybe you could give an explanation of how and why they're wrong in terms of his system, but they're not doing philosophy.
Right. Here are all the possible points of entry, and here's the exit, and if you're not there, too bad. This was all what we're talking about with respect to necessity, right? It's given that philosophy and the history of the way we've made sense of the world displays this kind of structure, you're either in or you're out on the dialectical road.
So we can contrast this to only a year ago or so, less than a year ago, we were doing Schopenhauer, and Schopenhauer's main target is Hegel, that he's complaining that actually the world in itself, which is more like Kant than Hegel says, in that it's cut off from everyday experience, but it is not rational. In fact, Schopenhauer thinks we positively can know in an indirect manner that it is chaos itself. It is entirely not the kind of thing that could be made into a science.
It's striving, in a way, it's desire.
Striving.
Yes. Yes, that's the way we know it.
Which is interesting because there's, at the beginning of this introduction, Hegel treats desire as a manifestation of rationality. He says everything flows from this logical structure.
And also religious striving, right? As it's a religious affect, religious feeling. He thinks that contains an element of truth in it. One kind of response to this kind of ambitious project is simply to say, hey, it crosses the bounds of human finitude, right? We can only understand a finite amount of things, and making these kind of grandiose claims about the total nature of human knowledge is just too much. This is a kind of response that occurs to anybody who's read Hegel, I think.
It's codified also within the last year. We talked about hermeneutics, which just explicitly straight up says, whenever you do an investigation, you're already coming to it with a bunch of assumptions and blah, blah, blah. There's no way to bootstrap yourself in philosophical method in the way that Hegel is trying to do here. But you were saying Schopenhauer, that's not his strategy. His strategy is not the one of humility. It is that we can positively know the opposite of what Hegel is saying.
I was actually thinking of Kierkegaard when I was talking about that, this whole notion of human finitude and divine absolute, and the fact that we as finite human beings are always cut off from the divine, and we shouldn't try to bridge that gap.
Kierkegaard was also reacting, if not to Hegel, but to Hegelians.
Hegelianism,
and its effect on the popular religious sentiments of his time. And that seems to be the target of Hegel's ire in here as well. It's just funny that Hegel sounds as grumpy as Schopenhauer often did in some of these prefaces. And, you know, the encyclopedia has three prefaces from different points, and then there's two of them in the logic here. Yes, he thinks that Kant is wrong in certain ways, but he thinks still Kant is so right in so much of, you know, he's going to appropriate so much of Kant self-consciously and respectfully. He just thinks that he's wrong about the thing in itself. But it's the sociological effects on philosophy of religion in particular that people who don't understand Kant, but just take the point of there are limits to human reason, and so faith. There's room for faith, and then religion comes all about feeling and... So we actually did an episode on Schleiermacher. Yeah.
Faith can't be a form of knowledge.
Right. Page 6 on the encyclopedia is interesting on this. From the mistaken view that the inadequacy of finite categories to express truth entails the impossibility of objective cognition, we derive a justification for pronouncing and denouncing according to our feelings and subjective opinions. Assurances present themselves in place of proofs, along with stories about all the, scare quotes, facts that are to be found in consciousness, and the more uncritical they are, the more they count as pure.
I'm sure that is not the most grumpy-sounding objection to popular religious post-Kantian sentiment that he has in there, but it does reflect, again, once you say, we can't know anything about the thing in itself, all we can know about is this world of experience, the world of appearances, then that gives rise to, well, what you just were describing there, Moog, sounds like phenomenology, right? Way post-Hegelian phenomenology. It sounds like intuitionism, right? We had another episode on G.E. Moore and other guys like that being moral intuitionists, that somehow we, since we can't know in itself, there's no God's law that we could figure out as far as morality goes, so we have to then just pay attention to our feelings. And the more pure, as you were saying, they are, then the more adequate they are. And that's all just stuff that Hegel has no patience with.
No time for it at all.
Well, and he characterizes this in the introduction just after what we were reading about the characterization of the older metaphysics and sort of articulating the path of failure of philosophy, talking about basically that philosophy has just renounced the understanding of reason at all. He says, turned against reason, this form of understanding behaves in the manner of ordinary common sense, giving credence to the latter's view that truth rests on sensuous reality, that thoughts are only thoughts, that is, that only sense perception gives filling and reality to them, that reason, insofar as it abides in and for itself, generates only mental figments. In this self-renunciation of reason, the concept of truth is lost, is restricted to the knowledge of mere subjective truth, of mere appearances, of only something to which the nature of the fact does not respond. Knowledge has lapsed into opinion. And what's interesting about that is that he's characterized exactly the kind of criticism of philosophy that people say, well, yeah, that's all it is. And he's saying, well, when you do that, you lose truth altogether. And so you've clearly gone astray.
Yeah, so this is another reference, obviously, to Kant and to this idea that reason is limited in its aspirations and that we can only apply to the categories to our experience. And so we lose the ability to know God, to know soul or self, and to know cosmos. And also, we lose the ability to know things in themselves. Later on, he's going to talk about sort of the irony of, so you say there's this world of appearances, which are not the things in themselves, and you say that truth is the correspondence of judgments to this world of things which aren't real. It's really a world of error and untruth. So we lose in this curtailment of application of reason to things in themselves and to God and all the rest of it, we lose the concept of truth as it's ordinarily understood. Kant's way of viewing truth is actually really, really weird when you think about it, this idea of truth as a relationship between judgment and appearance, as opposed to judgment and the world in itself.
Right. There's various ways in which I think that's kind of unfair to Kant. There's a way in which he phrases things which, I mean, obviously this sort of, just because the things are presented to us in a certain way, it doesn't mean they aren't real. Right.
Well, Kant would call them real, but real, empirically real, not transcendentally real. I mean, Hegel is judging this in terms of transcendental aspirations. Yes, if we curtail our aspirations and we're satisfied with empirical reality, as Kant defines it, then maybe we can be happy with that definition of truth. But it certainly is not the common sense, a naive realist notion of truth.
So we're nearing the halfway point of our discussion.
And we're 3 pages in.
Yes, but we keep jumping to giving a larger picture of Hegel's philosophy, which I think is appropriate and tends to be seemingly what we do as we're getting to the halfway point of the conversation on a consistent basis. I don't know why this is.
The true is the whole.
So just to sort of put what his problematic is going to be, what Hegel's problematic is going to be to explain what the relationship between experience and truth ultimately is. He does say, it's page 36 of the Encyclopedic Logic, so it's section 12 at the end of the this commentary on himself. So again, one of these later editions. He's been talking about the knowing of God and how it relates to empiricism. We can say that philosophy owes its first beginning to experience, that is, to what is a posteriori. But that is not saying much, for thinking is in fact essentially the negation of something immediately given. Just as we owe our eating to food, because without it we could not eat. Well, I'm not sure if begriff, how that relates, begriff, the concept that he wants to get at, how that relates to essence in the Aristotelian sense, but we've been sort of equating Aristotle and Hegel throughout here. So they're pretty damn close. It's not Hegel's term, I think, but that's what he's talking about in terms of getting at the concepts. Philosophical concepts are not just things you could just stipulate. They're things that, just like Plato thought, what is the real meaning of truth? What is the real meaning of virtue? That's where this thought of essences and concept, begriff, in Hegel comes from. And somehow we get at that stuff through experience. Of course we do. I mean, we get at everything through experience. But what's the right way of getting from the sensuous particulars to philosophical truth? It isn't just taking out the content and looking at the form, abstraction, in the way I was saying that we might get mathematical truths, but also not grasping immediately an essence. It's somehow we make the immediate into mediate knowing. We look at, again, the immediate as a metaphor for the truth or as a symbol of the truth. And we try to get at what this content is that is somehow behind but showing through the everyday thing. And all that really means is, again, we turn our everyday perceptions and dreams and whatever into actual thinking. We mull over are the stuff of our experience. And that somehow is how we come up with philosophy. But yet that sounds like everybody can think, so we can all philosophize. No, there's specific right ways to do it. You need training. It's very rigorous. It's very hard to think in the abstract, in the right way.
Speculative thought.
Exactly. It's unfortunate that the term speculation for us means something more like spitballing, like, yeah, I wonder if God is a giant piece of cheese. Let's speculate about the nature of God. Like, no, that's exactly the kind of arbitrary, whimsical thing that Haeckel would reject.
Right.
One way to ground that is you would, if you thought of theoretical physics and developing a new theory of gravity, what Einstein was doing, you would probably understand that as speculative thinking, directly along the lines of what Hegel's talking about, that you would do in philosophy, that is just utterly disciplined.
Okay, so that's the end of part one. Please come back next week for part two of the discussion, or you could pay your $5, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com, sign up to be a Partially Examined Life citizen. Don't you want to support us? Don't you think we do good things? You do. You have absolute knowledge that you do. So do that. And you don't have to wait until next week.